In this week's PAC, one of the biggest tutorials we've done in quite a while. It's going to be an in-depth look at PF, OpenBSD's firewall, with some practical examples and some different use cases. We're also going to be interviewing Peter Hanstein about the new edition of the Book of PF, which will be coming out sometime in the future here. Not sure when, but looking forward to it greatly. And we've also got news, and we're going to be going over a lot of the fallout and stuff from Heartbleed the last couple weeks. So lots of good and exciting stuff to hear about. So keep it tuned right now to BSD Now, the place to be, SD. BSD Now, episode 35, Puffy Firewall, recorded April 30th, 2014. Hey, I'm your host, Chris Moore.
And I'm Alan Jude.
And we're glad to have you guys with us this week. We're glad to be back. Alan, good to hear that you made it there and back safely from your conference. And yes. Of course, there's a lot of news to get caught up on since we were technically out last week. So first up, some of the big news, since this episode, of course, is all about PF. This is a good one to start with, about Alt-Q is being removed from PF. So what's the details on that, Alan?
So Alt-Q, it was designed 10-plus years ago, and when the idea of internet traffic shaping was brand new. Mm-hmm. And so it was very flexible and supported a bunch of different algorithms and stuff. But since then, people have learned that, you know, this one algorithm always is the best one. And that using it, you can actually kind of design the other algorithms inside of it if you have to. And a bunch of the original algorithms were only ever designed and there was never an actual implementation of it. And so because it was so flexible, it was also harder to configure. And so they basically, for OpenBSD 5.5, they'll have this new system that is just the best of the old system with all the other stuff ripped out. So you'll in 5.5, you'll still be able to use the old system. You just, instead of using the keyword Q, it'll be old Q, and the Q keyword will be the new system. But in 5.5, about 6 months from now, the old system will be completely retired.
Okay. So, of course, this doesn't affect FreeBSD, PCBSD Net, or Dragonfly, since all of our PFs are older and maintained separately. So maybe if you're running on OpenBSD current.
Yeah, so a bit more about Alt-Q and about the differences between the PFs is actually in our interview later in the show.
Good deal. Well, next up, we have some news about the FreeBSD quarterly status reports. I guess those just came out, detailing some of the project's ongoing tasks that have been happening this last quarter. So some of the interesting highlights include the first stable branch of ports, which I saw that go by. That's interesting. We also have some ARM improvements, including SMP. Wow, that's...
And support on basic support for the Google Chromebook. When we were in Tokyo, Peter Grehan actually brought one and gave it to a European developer, because apparently they're much harder to get in Europe than they are in the States. So he actually gave one to a developer, and it's up and running now.
We also have Beehive improvements, which is ongoing. There's lots of that happening all the time. We have more work. Oh, good.
Yeah, I wrote that status report because the developers were too busy developing the stuff to write a status report. So I wrote one up, and it was like, here, you guys check
this. Just for those of you out there who are wondering how you can get involved, I mean, there's a good example right there. There's developers you could just get some questions from and say what's going on, and then write up the report for them. I mean, that's a great way.
Exactly. It's like I follow Beehive closely because I'm interested in it, and so I knew what was new already.
Yeah,
and
very
so
cool.
I just had to write
it
down.
So we got more work on the test suite there is happening, and...
Yeah, and there is the ASLR stuff is in there. There's a status on that. Improvements to the iSCSI stack, like we talked about. The big one people are waiting for is UEFI boot support is now in the head. And the new virtual console stuff and the new... and the fact that they're working on a separate branch of the a second package repo that'll be built with the new Xorg system. So those that have the new mm-hmm. Virtual Console system and are testing it will be able to get the correspondingly compiled apps for it.
I'll be curious to play with that here in the near future. So there's also some specific updates from the cluster admin team. We got core team updates, doc team, port manager, email, and release engineering team. So there's just a lot of stuff. And of course, you'll want to hit the link after the show here and go take a look at that and read it for yourself. More than we can cover here. So, definitely. So
next, good stuff.
Continuing with our ongoing coverage of the fallout from the Heartbleed bug a couple weeks back, we got a ton of links and probably more than we can cover here today, but just all kinds of fallout from that, starting with some of the OpenBSD OpenSSL rewrite, which is still ongoing, and a hackathon, which begins in Morocco, Africa, of all places. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and there's also trip reports from some people that went there detailing, how they liked it.
Apparently they're going to call the fork of OpenSSL Libra SSL, which is interesting. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I wasn't a huge fan of the Libra office name back when they made it, but...
Well, it's kind of interesting. Well, it's the French word for free or whatever, but at the same time, it's always lib something, right? And so it's lib re SSL. So kind of redoing SSL. SSL.
Oh, that's a good idea. That is clever. I'll give him credit for that.
One of the cool things that we have a link here for is Ted Unangst actually kind of constructed a timeline of how Libre SSL actually came about. Because most people think that it started after Heartbleed, but it actually kind of started a little bit before with some of the other stuff. Like we talked about him finding those mitigation countermeasures and stuff, and he was like, "What is all this?" But he didn't really dig into it until later.
Well, that just kind of brought it all to the forefront, though, and kicked it into high gear.
Yeah, and if it had been just Heartbleed, they might, and it hadn't had the memory allocator thing, they might probably would not have done the fork. But he goes on to describe, this list of different things that went wrong all together to cause them to actually decide that they had to do a fork.
Sure.
One of the most glaring one was we just saw a FreeBSD and other BSD security notice about a fix for OpenSSL when it's used in a threaded application. Mm-hmm. That bug has been open in the OpenSSL bug tracker since like 2010 or 2012 or something like that. Quite a few years. It's been sitting open for like 4 years. And then somebody wrote a patch, and a bunch of people were like, yes, that patch fixes the problem. And it never got committed until like this week. And so that's kind of why the OpenBSD developers decided they had to kind of do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't look like we have the link here, but actually somebody has managed to put together the guts required to get Libre SSL running on FreeBSD and Linux.
Oh, sweet. That was fast.
Yeah, we were always kind of wondering how long it was going to take for them to get to making a portable version.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems somebody's already beat them to the punch and has the bits to pull in the libssl and libcrypto from OpenBSD and the guts that are required to get it to compile on Ubuntu 14.04, FreeBSD 10, and macOS 10.9.2.
Sweet.
It's not finished yet. It doesn't have CPU detection and configurable algorithm support and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's getting there.
Cool.
And it allows you to start playing with that stuff already, which is quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Interesting was recently some fixes in the OpenBSD branch about privilege separation to store RSA keys in separate processes, which will be a cool mitigation against key leakage from attacks such as Heartbleed and RelayD or OpenSMP TPD.
Yeah, so what they're doing there is the process that actually reads the private key off the disk is separate, and then the main process talks to it over the privilege separation iMessage system that OpenBSD has, so that the application that's actually talking to the user or the attacker never actually has access directly to the key that they might be trying to steal.
Mm-hmm.
And the operating system will enforce the separation of the memory and stuff, and that could be... I can see that becoming a trend, and almost every application kind of switching to that model.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, that's just so a lot of good stuff coming out of this. Even though Heartbleed was a major pain in the rear to everyone this last couple weeks, already we're seeing some good things come out of this.
Yeah, Ted's story about kind of how it came about also involves him being on a trip just before it happened, gets home, all he wants to do is shower, and apparently the water heater in the apartment above his broke, and so his bathroom was flooded, and while he was waiting for the maintenance guys, he had nothing better to do than dig into, why is OpenSSL not being mitigated by the stuff we have built in?
Sure.
And that so basically, it's entirely possible that this LibreSSL thing is all because of a water heater.
There you go. Well, cool. Next up in the news, we have some information about NetBSD. I guess 6.14 and 6.05 have been released.
Yes.
So these are new updates for the 6.1 and 6.0 branches of NetBSD, respectively, focusing on bug fixes. So, of course, the big update there is going to be the Heartbleed vulnerability. So you'll definitely want to upgrade your NetBSD boxes. There's also some fixes for some other security issues and even a kernel panic on, wait for it, the Atari. So please patch your Atari right now. This is serious business. Very cool. Well, that's a good one to end the weekly news roundup. Yeah. So, of course, we want to mention our sponsor for this week's show, which, as usual, is the awesome IX Systems. And a lot of stuff's been happening with them this last week. So what's some of the first things we have here, Alan?
The first one, actually, is they have another unboxing video with their new packaging. And it looks... quite interesting. You can see what it looks like when you buy one of the little FreeNAS minis, the new ones with the server Atom processors that support disk encryption and so on, or the encryption offloading. They also have a bunch of other stuff. They have the
developers update they did, and
The developer update talking about how some stuff they came up with at IX Systems is now implemented in the FreeBSD core infrastructure, and there's a bit in the FreeBSD status report about it. Talking about how we're now using Jenkins for continuous integration testing. So every time a new commit goes in, it starts building that code. And if there's a compile error or something detected, it can then kind of point us at which commit broke the tree. And when there's a lot of people working on it, that can be very valuable.
Definitely.
And so that was something that actually started out being used for FreeNAS, but is then now expanded and is part of the main FreeBSD project. And it talks about, and also Alexander Motin, his stuff that he talked about at EuroBSDCon with getting 1 million IOPS out of a bunch of desktop SSDs.
Nice.
And the work he did to improve the CAM and GOM layers to actually be able to scale up and not just have one CPU pegged while the others are idle and you know, when it should be going faster and all
looks
that
like they
work.
Also have the photos up from Linux Fest Northwest this last week. And I see you in one of those photos there, wearing the stylish OpenZFS shirt.
Yep, there's a couple of different photos of me in it, and they got some photos of the Jupiter Broadcasting booth where they were doing a live stream for both days of the conference. And there was lots of cool stuff. Saw some 3D printers. Found out, I didn't know this, but you can 3D print in metal, not only
that's
plastic.
Cool. Yeah, that's neat. Okay. And of course, because it is another week, we have a new FreeNAS version to announce. So I guess 9.2.15 called Waking Up Edition. So I'm trying to read here the notes. It looks like some more bug fixes in it. Fixes some of the bugs in the 9.2.1.x series, including all those we dreamed about while we were in 9.2.1.4.1. I'm confused.
Apparently they had a very minor update and they decided to do a fifth digit on the version number, and then they decided that was a really really bad idea, so now we have 9.2.1.5.
okay, that works. Well, cool.
There was an interesting story about that Linux Fest Northwest.
Well, that's cool. So now that we've mentioned a whole bunch of that, of course, we want to tell you about the company that actually makes all this happen, which, of course, is IX Systems, sponsor of this show, who can, of course, corporate sponsors of FreeNAS, PCBSD, and just runs a whole lot of stuff in the BSD arena, including going to all these conferences, such as Linux Fest Northwest.
Yeah, they had a great booth, and I would say out of, you know, there were like 30 or 40 different booths set up at Linux Fest, and most of them had some kind of swag giveaway, you know, stickers and t-shirts and all that stuff. But the most popular thing, the only thing I ever got stopped in the hallway and asked, where did you get that? I want that.
Of course.
Is the BSD horns. Even at a Linux event, they are the most.
If you see anybody with those on at a Linux conference, it's a safe bet that somewhere the IX system guys have a booth and are handing them out. You best go grab them quick because they tend to go very early in the morning.
Yes, Ben was purposely only putting out a couple at a time, trying to make it so that if you came in the afternoon, you would still stand a chance of maybe getting there.
Cool. We want to mention, of course, if you go to ixsystems.com/BSD now, you can go ahead and visit that site there and fill out some information and also download a cool guide they've put together on the ultimate guide for buying a new server for open source. So 11 of the key traits you must absolutely demand from whoever your provider is. And of course,
It kind of explains why IX is better than Dell or HP or all the things IX can do for you that they can't.
Yeah, just stuff you should know going into it, for sure.
And it's also a very useful guide when you, as the administrator or whatever, the guy that wants the server, knows you want it from IX Systems, but you have to convince your boss, right? So this gives them, you know, it's that marketing material. It's something to combat the little book from Dell that does the same thing. It provides, you know, it's good for convincing your boss. I'm lucky. I don't have to convince my boss to buy from IX Systems. I can just call up IX and order what I want, which I did. I actually did that last week.
Ooh, do we get another unboxing video? IX. That would be cool.
Yeah, that'll probably be a week or two still.
That would be fun. Of course, all their stuff's powered by the latest and greatest Intel processors, Xeons, and everything from the FreeNAS Mini up to these behemoth systems that they've rolled out.
That's the other thing I always like is that I can always get the brand newest stuff from IX. You know, like the E5-2620V2, right? A lot of other places, you kind of have to wait until they design a new version of the hardware to get the newer processor. It's like, no, I want new stuff now. IX is always ready
on top
to
of that. So again, that URL is ixsystems.com/BSD now, and go ahead and let them know we sent you. If you guys contact them or looking for something new, just mention that you heard about them on the BSD Now show. Well, cool. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with our interview for the week with Peter Hanstein. Okay, we're joined now by Peter Hanstein, OpenBSD contributor and author of the Book of PF. Glad to have you with us today, Peter.
Oh, glad to be with you, man.
Well, first up, we're going to, of course, ask you the basic question. How did you get involved in BSD? What was the road that led you here?
Oh, it was a long, winding road, actually. Like most other people, I stumbled into Unix when I was fairly young. But then again, back then, Unix ran on stuff that basically I couldn't afford to keep myself. So we were off to PC land for a little while. Now, when I started getting involved with the BSDs, very, very gradual process, I was running a small consulting slash documentation company. And we needed some better connectivity than we had. So I looked into bringing up what I've heard about, which happens to be FreeBSD, that FreeBSD 205, I think. I never had this little problem. I managed to boot CD, but then when it booted, it couldn't actually read from it anymore. So I ended up for a while playing with Linux, setting up, your basic gateway and small business services on the various Linuxes for a while. Then, as hardware support improved over the years, I was nudging myself back, and it just very gradually myself having replaced all Linux servers with either OpenBSD or FreeBSD over a few years. And when I reached that point, I also started very informally helping other people in the Linux user group and just locally around Bergen. Slowly developed into me starting to do tutorials, going to conferences, and long and winding road, and ended up with the book of PF, which is now, well, will soon have its third edition. We're still working. So,
well, that's a good lead-in for Alan's next question.
Yeah.
Yeah, the question was kind of, how did you go from just being a regular user to actually being the author of the book of PF?
Well, lots of long nights of doing crazy stuff with it. And, well, basically collecting notes. And like this also said in, I think it still says in the introduction to the book of PF, that this actually started up at, I started out as a user. And then the next thing that happened was, a short time before I wrote that user group lecture, I've been one of a large number of reviewers on Greg Leahy's Complete Free Beastie, this third edition, I think. So I sent the manuscript to him, and just asking, well, is this something to keep working on? And I said, yes. Why don't you come to August 2005 and do a tutorial? And so basically going from conference to conference, doing odd little jobs for people, and just collecting, going on, collecting notes. Yeah, so basically it's accumulated over quite a few years. So I guess the manuscript is now the book of PF.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing that on and off for about 10 years now. So it's time I started doing something different.
Mm-hmm. So,
PF seems to only be getting
bigger.
Yeah,
it's slowly expanding. I've been doing other stuff as well. Like all my little sketches of things tend to end up in my blog, anyways.
Mm-hmm. So, give us a little background for people who aren't familiar with PF. What makes it so special? What makes it stand out, you know, from the rest of the crowd as far as firewalls are concerned?
Well, what attracted me to PF was, basically, I was part of OpenBSD. OpenBSD was, well, after wandering through quite a few different Unixes, OpenBSD was the first one I stumbled into that fit the way I think. You know, it's, you install a base system, all the basics are there. You can add packages, but, you know, for something basic, like building a firewall, you know, building load balancers, building a lot of stuff. It's there. Every file on that system before you start mucking with it has a man page. So it was quite a good place to start. And coming from, well, my previous firewall was Linux IP tables, and coming from IP tables and discovering, my first OpenBSD firewall was with IPF, but only just going from IP tables, which is basically a fire off a lot of commands, and to something that actually loads a readable config file, you know, that was heaven. And once they started working on PF, they've done a lot of cleanup of the syntax. Well, they still have this sort of like Henning said in the lecture once, PF syntax was from a bad OC wrote IPF, so everything was upside down, which means the last match wins. So that takes a bit of getting used to, I guess. PF started almost called it a revolution, or at least a slow evolution of utilities in developing OpenBSD, that they tend to use basically parts of the same library for parsing config files, and these config files are actually quite human readable. They don't the config files are not as cryptic as, well, say, sendmails. So that helps a lot. And yeah, well, that's another recent development in OpenBSD, the OpenSMTPD, which has a config file syntax, which is actually fairly similar to PFs. You know, it has the accept for relay from and so forth. So it's definitely worth looking into. So yeah, basically, PF was what PF was the first firewall that made me feel productive.
Yeah, like
I can just belt out some rules, and sometimes when you just type something in without thinking, of course it will not be the correct syntax, but you know the syntax is so logical. Yeah, it builds up, and you got the got a fairly good tool set for actually debugging when your logic breaks. You you can spot it fairly easily. It's the first the first networking tool that I stumbled across that made me feel like I was more productive than the previous one.
In school, they started out with teaching us like Cisco PICs and IP tables, and you know, you learn it, whatever. And then the next semester, we were introduced to IPF, the predecessor to PF, and it was like, I like that better. Not only because the rules are easier to write and so on, but when I come back to it a month later and I look at my rules with PF, because they're English, like, I can read and tell what it's doing. Even if I had to look up how to write the rule the first time, when I read it, I can tell exactly what it's going to do. With IP tables, because you're just using cryptic command line flags everywhere, you have to use the man page to decipher each line and figure out what it's actually doing. Mm-hmm. Whereas in PF, even someone that has never seen PF before can read those rules and know exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah,
even if it takes a little bit more to write them, they're human readable.
I think that's still one of the major forties of PF, that it's like you just said, you can write a rule set and come back 3 months later and it still makes sense. You can mostly make sense of it three months later. Of course, it helps if you have sensible comments as well, but even an uncommented rule set without any comments at all will be fairly understandable. So,
yep. Or even just the ability to tag rules with a comment so that when something gets blocked, the message also includes why, so that it makes debugging a lot easier.
Yeah, you can do that. There are a number of the techniques that's like that have developed over the years. So, one of the very nice things about PF is that it's actually developed and it's developed by people who make a living using it every day. So
They didn't write a firewall
all the
because
improvements,
the operating system
changes in PF come.
Real world usage. People are actually using this to do real work.
Yeah. So
Well,
that's also, I guess, also one of the reasons behind the long list of changes. It's been changing quite a bit over the years, so there's no way you could. I don't think you can actually come up with a config that would load properly in OpenBC 3.0 and will still load unchanged in OpenBC 5.5. But that's a good thing.
So, what exactly is the Book of PF? Like, how's it laid out?
The original intention was that this was something that would take you from something that you should be able to read in that in an afternoon, a fairly good overview of what you can do with PF, and it should have enough examples in it that you can actually get started. And everyone comes with a big fat ammunition that says, "Well, don't cut and paste from my stuff because your network is subtly different." So, well, starting from that, I think it's about, 250 pages now? Something like that. Well, the third edition isn't finalized yet, so I can't tell the exact page number. Mm-hmm. It's still not a big book, but it's intended to take it from fairly basic level and at least have you give you a taste of what you can do for more complicated setups or just for optimizing whatever it is you need.
Mm-hmm.
So get you started on at least a basic level and show you all the nice tools.
So speaking of the
stuff.
Oh, good.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, speaking of, you just mentioned the third edition, like what's changed exactly that prompted this new third edition?
There have been some incremental changes, but what prompted the third edition was the new traffic shaping system. That's finally now in the OpenBSD 5.5. The background for OpenBSD and all the BSDs for a while have had alt queue for traffic shaping. The thing about alt queue is back when that was written, traffic shaping was really fairly groundbreaking research. So they had a number of different algorithms they wanted to try out. So I think what the version of alt queue that was in OpenBSD for quite a few years had, I think, three different algorithms. The configuration syntax became quite confusing because of that. There was almost sort of a threshold for getting started with traffic shaping because, well, you would have to do surgery on your pass rules and assign them to the right queue, and so it could be fairly invasive. When you have a basic config that works, you're sort of reluctant to start mucking around with it again, at least in production.
Mm-hmm.
All that became, I'd say, incrementally easier in OpenBSD 4.6 when we got match rules. So you could do things like queue assignment in a mat block of match rules and not touch your pass rules. Now, FreeBSD doesn't have that yet, and I think that's a great shame. A few more years on, and people have been using traffic shaping for so long now that whilst a lot of the... First off, not all the theoretical algorithms were ever implemented properly. And it turns out that you don't really need to have all those variations. What the underlying algorithm in all the shaping in the new system is the hierarchical first service curve, HFSC, which... and I quote Henning here, you can express all the other disciplines in HFSC. And it comes with a totally different, actually human-readable syntax. So that was, well, the new traffic shaping system that was they started hinting at in Jero, it took 2.5 years more before it was actually the complete thing was included in time for 5.5.
Mm-hmm.
With the new traffic shaping system, I had been anticipating that for a while, and I mentioned it to Bill at NoStarch and a few times. I said, well, we'll see when it actually arrives. After a bit of back and forth, and let's think about it, well, I said, well, my editors say let's go, so let's do it. So that's the that's the third edition. Then again, there's been things always take longer when they went into the well, so we're still editing that. I'm now that it's quite definite we won't be releasing simultaneously with OpenBSD 5.5. I think it will be still, well, sometime into the summer, I think, but we don't have a definite date yet. We're still with printing involved, and as I said, we're still editing. Thanks to Henning Brower's tech review, there's some late dated improvement to the book as well. And while we're on the subject of the book, if you ever want to write a tech book, you really want to do it with no stars, because they edit you. they have a wonderful method of making you write about the subject a lot better than you would have done by yourself. Mm-hmm. And they pick really good tech editors as well. So, just some like Michael Lucas's books. His independently published books are quite good as well. But something like the Absolute Open BSD, I don't think that would happen without a publisher like Starch Press. If you're shopping around for a tech publisher, Nostar should definitely be on your list.
So I guess that kind of leads into the next question: is there anyone else involved in the book besides you? And I guess obviously the publisher and Henning as a tech reviewer, but is there anyone else?
There are quite a few people behind the scenes at the publisher, where you have a production editor. Well, takes you, or development editor, I think they call it, takes you through review your initial draft and make suggestions, one or two rounds of that, and after that it goes to the tech editor, who in my case was Henning Brower. And once we're through with that, it goes to a copy editor, who basically weeds out any strangeness in your language. Mm-hmm. And once that's complete, it goes to the formatting people, who stuff it into something like InDesign or FrameMaker, I think, and produce your camera-ready copy and find the ebook. So once I'm done with the finer points of language, it's still, I think, a couple of weeks' work for somebody doing the typesetting, and then the thing is to be printed. So that's what the delay is.
Do any of the proceeds of these sales go back to the OpenBSD Foundation?
Not directly. We have had some discount codes where you enter into the No Star Press ordering page, mm-hmm. a code, and that diverts some of the some percentage of the cover price to OpenBSD. There's also the possibility of buying directly via the OpenBSD bookstore. And in either case, if you buy either directly from No Starch Press or from the OpenBSD bookstore, if you order the paper version, you will also immediately get an email telling you where to pick up the ebook version. Those ebooks are DRM free, so basically we trust you to do the right thing.
Cool.
So how and where do you personally use PF?
Well, anywhere I'm in charge, I use I use something with PF to direct traffic in and out of my network. Unfortunately, at this time, I'm not involved in any large-scale networks, so it's basically my personal stuff and a few installations for old fans.
Have you ever done any really interesting setups?
I guess the most massive one was when it was in front of a load balancing setup in front of one of the site called Orego in Norway. It used to be a kind of a social network thing that I think more or less morphed into the back end for the socialist newspapers in this country. I'm not sure it's actually running anymore, partly because the company I set it up for went bankrupt a few years back. So
that'd be a good reason.
But there could still be something with my paw prints on it in there. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. What I've done, all the configurations that have been the most popular have been the ones with spam D involved. That's so easy to understand for people. You just plop something down in front of whatever your real mail server is, and you have the load on your real mail server goes down. Mm-hmm. Recently, we also done sort of a what's almost an appliance where the little open beastie box does the spam D gray listing and so forth, but it also does the content filtering. And once it's done with that, well, whatever hasn't gone through, whatever's been able to pass through SpamD, and in my case SpamSS and ClamD, just gets forwarded to the real mail server, which is not directly accessible to the public. Mm-hmm. So, which is also a nice method of handling your spam.
Cool.
And basically, it's something I tend to set up with it inside of 1 hour. So.
Wow, reflect. Well, changing gears a little bit, what's your opinion on some of the other BSDs lagging so much behind on their PF, or, for example, FreeBSD forking it?
Well, I think FreeBSD is missing out on quite a few goodies. Mm-hmm. And stopping at 4.5 is an odd choice because, 4.5 was a nice release, but after that, you know, for 6, you got match rules. So match rules, so you can perform actions on a packet without deciding whether it's going to pass or not. You could do stuff like NAT, you can tag it, you can, well, a lot of transformations, they're essentially useful. I feel a little sad that it's not in for FreeBSD users. It's a little sad these things are not in there. Mm-hmm. Another thing I don't think arrived until 4.6 was pflow, which is the export of NetFlow metadata taken from the state table.
Yep.
I don't think that's in FreeBSD either quite yet.
Mm-mm. I don't think so either.
Oh. So, and then again, there was a fairly thorough rewrite of anything to do with NAT and 4.4.7, which is also when the syntax changed. And I can understand that. Well, it's sort of uncomfortable when you're about to break people's setups, but I think it's worth it. So,
it was awkward there, especially being in the middle of a stable release for FreeBSD. And I think the other thing that contributed a lot to FreeBSD doing its own thing was that they had just finished a lot of changes to local patches to PF for SMB scaling. Like PF and FreeBSD 10 can actually take advantage of all the cores on a machine and get much better performance, but then cool it's missing stuff. All these newer features.
It's probably it's been a while now, so there are a lot of changes on the OpenBSD side, probably also surgery has been done on the FreeBSD network stack. So it would take some serious effort.
But at the VeriSign conference, VBSDCon, there was some talk about doing a fresh port of the OpenBSD one into FreeBSD, and then just re-implementing
we'll see if that comes,
stuff.
Yeah, it comes out again at BSDCAN in a couple weeks.
Yeah, it would be interesting to hear about that.
It was, I think it was Baptiste Rosson that volunteered, but he was drunk at the time.
Oh, yeah, well.
And he's obviously very busy with our package system, so.
Well, anyway, it would be great if the, in other words, some movement there, because they're, well, of course, I'm sort of in the middle of it, too, because I tend to maintain document as to has to be in sync with several operating systems, and
as those diverge more, that gets more difficult.
If I could get out easy by just contributing that patch to the FreeBSD handbook and just have somebody else maintain that, but it keeps coming back with each version of the book, and to some extent for the the PS tutorial, which when it has a lot of parallel material in it, and I would love to see that to let Delta become a little smaller.
Sure.
Yeah, but we should mention that as well. Is that you're running the tutorial at BSD?
Yes, and
year.
I'm. Well, I realized I got to the point where there's just too much slides. I'll never ever get through those because. Well, other conferences have full-day tutorials, if you ask them nicely. And BSDCAN, they're always half-day. And half-day in BSDCAN is 3 hours. Now, I have something like 220, maybe 250 slides. There's no way you're going to get through that in 3 hours. And there's no way all that's going to be interesting or useful to... just this random group of people. So I took the approach I asked people to send me an email if you have an idea what you're going to be interested in, please tell me so I can sort of tailor the session to your needs. Unfortunately, I only had a couple of answers, and they were not really specific. So I'll just need to I'll be reshuffling my slides again and see if I can make some logical grouping that will work. But so basically, present people with the menu and where do we go from here? And of course this in a flash of ambition, I submitted two tutorials for BSDCAN, and both were accepted. The other one is addition to OpenBSD 5.5. And for this one, I don't have a massive amount of slides, but it's, it's hopefully the way to, how to migrate your stuff to OpenBSD 5.5. Now, anyone who has a question about that, please send me an email. Even if you're not going to be at the tutorial in Ottawa, because if there's something you thought about and haven't quite figured out, well, probably somebody else has that problem as well.
Yeah. Cool. And you're also on the program committee for EuroBSDCon. Can I just tell people a little bit about that?
Yeah, the EuroBSDCon is in late September in Sofia, Bulgaria, and basically two people from each of the major BSDs on the committee, and we'll be selecting from whatever people send in to submission at EuroBSDCon.org. I think the deadline now is May 19th. Which is something like the day after BSDCAN. Of course, if we're not happy with what we got then, we might extend the deadline. But we're still looking for submissions, and we're very, very nice people. I've never been to Sofia, but I've been to Bulgaria, and it's a good place. I got it's a pleasant place with reasonable prices for good food and drink, and mm-hmm. You'll be surrounded by geeks there. You know,
yes.
What could be better?
Chris and I were both at EuropeaSticon last year, and it was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Malta that was good as well. Yes.
So, can you give us an estimate on when you expect the new book to be released?
We don't actually have a date yet.
Okay, so no, you know, hints.
I think you kind of mentioned late summer, but it's hard to say.
Okay, cool. We of course will cover it when you guys do.
This week's tutorial is on PF, the packet filter. But first, let's start with a little history. The year was 2001, and OpenBSD was using IPFilter as their firewall. It was also available in FreeBSD and NetBSD. The world seemed to be at peace, until a new clause was added to the license for IPFilter. With this change, all modifications to the software required the author's approval. This was obviously unacceptable for many reasons, so the OpenBSD team ripped it out of their tree. The problem now was that OpenBSD had no firewall. Rapid development happened, mainly by Daniel Hartmeier and a few others, and before long, OpenBSD had a new in-house firewall called PF, or Packet Filter. Since then, it's been ported to FreeBSD, NetBSD, DragonflyBSD, and macOS 10. The problem with those ports is that they're all out of date now, or have since diverged from mainline PF. FreeBSD's PF is from OpenBSD 4.5, and Dragonfly's is from 4.4, and NetBSD is somewhere around that same time frame. The customized version of PF in FreeBSD 10 is actually an improvement in one specific area, the scaling on SMP systems. So it actually can push more traffic if you have a multi-core processor than OpenBSD can. NetBSD has also started their own new rewrite of PF called NPF. We're hoping to get an interview on that later in the year. To make matters worse, the configuration syntax for PF changed in between OpenBSD 4.6 and 4.7, and that's one of the reasons that some of the other BSDs like FreeBSD haven't caught up to the newer PF features. They don't want users to reboot their firewall and the rules not work anymore and be locked out of their machine. Leaving that debate aside, we have in this tutorial, we'll actually cover both different syntaxes. So depending which type of system you're using, a newer OpenBSD or an older FreeBSD, or a newer FreeBSD with an older PF, you'll need to be careful on which set of instructions you follow. Hopefully one day all the firewalls will be united again, but until that time, we'll have to deal with a little bit of split brain. Probably goes without saying, but PF is not a simple tool. It's actually kind of complex, and it has a lot of options and features because you might be using it in a lot of different situations, like using it as a router or a gateway, a server, or desktop, or whatever. So that's why we're having a tutorial. There's also the great book of PF, who we just talked to the author of in the interview, and it covers a lot of this in much more depth than we can in a short tutorial. As an example, what we're going to do is look at this desktop rule set. This is a basic set of firewall rules, quite simple, but we're going to break down each line and actually explain what they do. And there's also some notes here on the differences between the newer PF and the older style. So, starting with the first line, we're actually just defining a macro. So you're saying ext_if equals em0. And this is basically creating a macro, which is like a shell variable, where we're saying the external interface is em0. This isn't any special meaning. We're just going to use this later in the script so that in the event that your external interface changes, you won't have to update it in all the places in the script. You can just update the variable once. Next, we're actually creating a variable that is a list of different BOGON networks. This is the entire RFC 1918 internal address set, all of the multicast addresses, loopback, the DHCP auto configuration, and 0.0.0.0/8 and all that nonsense, and the entire experimental range of IP addresses. So, right, we're creating this one variable that contains all of those invalid, unrouted networks. Then we have our block-policy. So the set command sets a variable for future rules to go by. In this case, we want the firewall to silently drop packets instead of returning a TCP reset to the sender. Right, so this is a policy setting. We can either, with our block policy, can either be to drop the packet silently or to return an error message to the person who sent the packet. Now, you might actually want to have, you know, one policy for internal traffic and one policy for external traffic. Right? If traffic is coming from inside your network and being blocked, it's best to send the reset back so the application gets the error immediately instead of timing out or having to wait for the timeout. But if it's external, you might decide that you don't want to have to be sending those packets and be susceptible to that kind of denial of service or just flood attack. Then we can also set skip. In this case, we're setting the skip on the LO0 interface, which is loopback. And so the firewall just ignore it completely, which is what you usually want to do with localhost traffic. Match rules also allow you to apply stuff to a rule or to match traffic and apply a rule to it, but without specifically passing or blocking it, so that it will then also match later rules and go through the regular set. In this case, we're setting the scrub action. And what this is going to do is clean up the packet and reassemble it and all that kind of stuff so that we know that it basically won't let any traffic through that has invalid TCP flag combinations or is in any way invalid. We can also enforce a maximum segment size, right? Normally, you know, with your MTU on Ethernet being 1500, you don't want to have impossibly large packets coming through. And we can also use the no-df, which will block anything with the, or will clear the do not fragment bit on the packets coming in. There's also the anti-spoof action. It protects against packets from spoofed or forged IP addresses. If you apply the quick keyword here, that changes the default behavior of PF. By default in PF, packets come in and go through the list of rules, and it's the last match rather than typically the first match. It's the last rule that matches that applies. However, if you put the quick keyword in, that means as soon as this rule matches, it stops looking at the rest of the rules and processes the packet in that way. Then we can have our block in and out rules. In this case, we're going to block in and out all packets that are IPv6. If you don't have IPv6 connectivity, then it's a good idea. And then our next rule is to block any inbound traffic from $broken, which is that macro we defined earlier with all the invalid addresses. Also, any addresses that match the unicast reverse path forwarding test, and any packets from an address that's not routable. So that'll block any incoming traffic that is in some way bogus. Then we have our block in all rule. In this case, it'll block all incoming packets by default, but you see it doesn't say quick, so that means that any rule after this will also match the traffic. So by saying block everything and then allow these certain things, then if a packet gets all the way through and doesn't match any other rule except for block all, then it won't be allowed through. Then we have our pass out quick on, and then we see our macro for our external interface, inet keep state. What the keep state will do here is, so when we connect out, it will remember which address we connected out to. And then when a packet comes back in, the reply to our request comes back in, it'll be like, we see that the traffic in this case is actually related to the outbound connection we made, so we'll allow that back through. In this way, you have what's called a stateful firewall, hence keep state, which means that any connections from inside going out, the replies are allowed back in, but outside cannot initiate an unrequested connection inbound. then we have our simple block in pass out. So that'll block any incoming connections, but pass anything out. So anybody inside the network is allowed to connect out to the internet, but anything coming in is blocked. But because we have that keep state rule, this creates a dynamic rule for every outbound connection, allowing the reply to that connection to come back in. Now, on a server, we'd want pretty much the same thing, except for we'll have to enhance it slightly. In this particular case, we'll set up some additional rules. So we create this table called children's that has the persist flag. And that basically will keep a list of addresses in memory. Any IPs in this table will have their connections dropped without further processing. All right, so we create a table, and then we set the rule that says block in quick proto TCP from children's to any. We can also create a table that persists with a file. This is similar to the previous table, except for the contents of a file are used when it loads up and is flushed when it is updated. So this is basically, in this case, is a list of Chinese IP addresses that we want to block from attempting to connect to port 22 and attempting to connect to our SSH server. We can also use PFCTL, the control program for PF, to modify a table. In this case, we can tell PF to remove any entries from the table that have been there for more than 24 hours. So you could set this up in a cron job to automatically age out attackers and things like that. So you can temporarily block certain types of traffic. In this rule, we say pass in on our external interface any TCP packets from any source address to any destination address on port 80 with the flags S/SA, which is SYN or SYN-ACK. And we'll also do a SYN proxy and keep state on that. This will pass all TCP traffic from any address inbound to us on port 80, or you could replace the any with your specific IP addresses. Since we used the quick keyword in the previous rule, which will block Chinese addresses, only non-Chinese addresses will be able to connect to us. The SYN proxy enables PF's built-in handshake validation ability. This helps prevent SYN flood attacks and comes at the price of slightly reduced speed, but it'll keep people from being able to do a SYN attack against your web server. The next rule, pass in on external interface TCP from 1.2.3.4 to any port 137, 139, 445, and 138. These will basically only allow a certain IP address to connect to us on things like the Windows file sharing ports. The next rule says pass in on our external interface, proto TCP, to any port SSH with the flags S/SA keep state. So this will allow any incoming connections to our SSH server, and so we'll only match packets with SYN or SYN-ACK, which is the part of the handshake. But then by saying keep state, once the connection is set up, then the rest of the packets will be allowed through as normal. We also say max source con 5. This will allow each source address to only be able to establish 5 concurrent connections. So while people can connect to the SSH server, each unique source address can only have 5 concurrent connections, and anything further will be blocked. We also say max source con rate. This limits how many connections can be created. In this case, any connections beyond 5 within 5 seconds will be blocked. So you're only allowed to initiate 5 new connections every 5 seconds, even if you only maintain one of those concurrently. And anything that exceeds those rates gets their IP address added to the children's table, which will then block all of their traffic. And then we have that PFCTL rule that will expire them. So if someone tries to connect too many times, they get added to the list and are blocked, and after a certain amount of time, they are removed from the list. And then last, we have pass INET proto ICMP, ICMP type echo request. So this allows our ping to go back and forth. On a gateway, we have a little bit more to add. We now define a macro for our internal interfaces. So that's one or more interfaces that reside on our internal network. We can also set log interface. The egress keyword means the interface with the default route. So whichever, so when we're logging a packet, we'll log it from the interface where it's going to leave rather than the interface where it entered the firewall. And then we have match out on egress, right? Egress is always going to be your address, that the interface that has the default route. It's a handy way to identify the interface instead of having to know which interface traffic is going to leave on. So we're saying any traffic that's leaving our network that is not from the network of the external interface and it's coming in, we'll NAT it to our egress interface. So this does our network address translation. It's a very useful thing for your gateway to do. All of the attached LAN clients with their internal IPs will be able to access the internet, and PF will keep track of who made which connection and route it back, just like normal. So then we can also create our NAT rule. So we'll say NAT on the external interface from the internal interface network to any via the external interface. Then we can also block out log quick on egress proto UDP from any to any port 53. In this specific case, we're going to block all outbound DNS requests and log that, the fact that we blocked them. In our router tutorial, we actually set up DNS crypt so that all DNS requests are routed through a separate application that's going to make encrypted DNS requests. So we don't want any unencrypted DNS requests to leak from our network. We can also say pass in on the egress interface TCP anything bound for the egress interface on port 222 and redirect that to an internal machine. This is basically our port forwarding rules, which allows us to have certain ports on the outside of the network be routed to a specific machine inside the network behind NAT. It's, yes, like port forwarding. If you're using an older rule set, then it's the redirect rule. So instead of a regular pass rule and then as an option redirect to something, we create a specific redirect rule. But other than that, they look mostly the same. And then we can also pass in on our egress interface anything to port 2222 with flags syn or synack. And we'll syn proxy that. We also have to create a rule to pass all traffic on the internal interface into the router so it can go through. We want all of our machines on our network to be able to talk. In this case, our internal interface is actually a list of interfaces. So even if you have two separate subnets behind your router that are normally segregated, they'll be able to talk by passing packets through the router. And then we have this example of how you can use host names in a PF rule. So we'll say pass in quick on our internal interface TCP from any machine to ubuntu.com and instead redirect that to bsdnow.tv. So now anybody behind the router that tries to go to ubuntu.com will have their packets redirected to bsdnow.tv. And then we have the example of how to do that same rule except on an older version of PF. Lastly, we have another example of redirection. If someone thinks they're smarter and choosing a custom DNS server instead of the ones we've set up with DHCP, we can silently redirect those requests back to the internal resolver, right? So pass in on our internal interface protocol TCP or UDP from any to any host that is not our DHCP server on port 53, redirect it back to our DNS server. And so that's the end of our basic overview of what PF can do. But there's a lot more, and you can look into it more. But also the pfctl command can give you lots of interesting statistics about your current network, including how long it takes to search through the state table to find specific items and so on. But I hope you enjoyed our little tutorial that actually explains, rather than our previous PF tutorial was mostly about how to get it up and running and here's a list of rules, this time we kind of got to walk through that list of rules and explain what each one does, and hopefully whet your appetite and get you to read into the documentation yourself, or pick up Peter's book, The Book of Pia.
Okay, next up, our weekly news roundup. We're going to go quickly through some of the other notables from the past week. So first up, we have the new Xorg is now the default in FreeBSD. So for those who don't know what that is, for a long time now, FreeBSD has had two versions of X11 in ports. The older stable version was still the default, but you could install a newer one by having with the new Xorg set in your make.conf. That's what we've been building a PCBSD with for quite a while now. And that brings in all the latest Intel drivers, KMS, et cetera, the AMD KMS stuff as well. Yeah. So they've finally made the switch in the FreeBSD ports tree for this for 10 stable and 9 stable.
Yep. We'll see 9.3 coming out of 9 stable in the fairly new future, so they wanted to get this in. So they basically reversed it now. And so instead of having to put with new Xorg in your make.conf to get the new one, you have to do without new Xorg in order to get the old one.
Yep. Yep, so that's cool. That's neat to see it pushing forward, and that'll be a cool feature to have in 10.1, a FreeBSD when that hits.
9.3 as well. And the other interesting thing is they're setting up a temporary package repository with all the packages compiled with the new Xorg stuff, so that you'll be able to have all of the apps without having to compile them yourselves.
Sweet.
And I think this is integral to supporting like the GNOME 3.12 and stuff that you guys were looking at. And
yeah,
that's why PCBSD has been using this already.
For a long time. I mean, we've needed the 3D acceleration because you can't run a lot of things without it now. Yep. So we've been using it for a while, and it's pretty solid. I mean, it sure beats not having a 3D driver. So you kind of don't have a choice. But I see that they finally made that the default. Yep. It's about time. So next up, we have a Google Summer of Code News. We have a bunch of the accepted BSD projects here and some links to those. So let's see, we have accepted project proposals uploaded to see what's planned. So first up, OpenBSD. Their list includes some DHCP configuration parsing improvements. We have a systemd replacements, porting Capsicum over, GPT and UEFI support, and modernizing their DHCP daemon. So
having GPT on OpenBSD will be interesting. Finally have better support for large disks and so on. Utilities to supplement for systemd replacement. That seems interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Providing some of the functionality that systemd has that obviously won't be available in the BSDs, at least for a while. That is quite interesting.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, hopefully some of that will be portable and we'll be able to pull that into FreeBSD as well.
So we also have a full list from BSD project with a lot of interesting projects going on this summer. We have starting up porting FreeBSD on Android emulator, so that's pretty cool.
That seems really interesting.
Yeah, CTF implementation and use in the kernel debugger. And we have improved Unicode support in FreeBSD, high-speed firewall, converting IPFW PF rules to a C module, flexible dependencies with package, FreeBSD on MicroBlaze, implementation of the EV dev protocol and touchscreen support for Xorg. That's pretty cool. FreeBSD Pixie pre-seed installations. We got some Beehive stuff with instruction caching, kernel debugging support for LLDB, Intel SMAP and kernel patching framework. This one I'm actually kind of interested in is a modular scripting system for FreeBSD loader with Lua. So that could be cool. And one that actually is a new enhanced boot splash screen for FreeBSD, so we can make a little nicer boot up process. BSNMP enhancements, package pluggable repositories, and then machine readable output from user land utilities. So a lot of
nice.
How many is that, like 15? There's a number of them they got in this.
16 projects on FreeBSD plus at least 5 or 6 on OpenBSD. That's a lot of interesting stuff we hope to get to
see. Sure, so we want to wish good luck to all the students participating, and hopefully this is your...
Big thanks to all the mentors.
Yes, definitely. Hopefully this is your foot in the door, which eventually leads you to becoming a full-time BSD user. So looking forward to working with you guys. So what's our next story this week, Alan?
The complexity of the FreeBSD VFS layer, using ZFS as an example, part 2. We talked about part 1 a while ago, but now they have... part 2. This is actually from a guy that works on ZFS full-time and particularly works with FreeBSD as well. Does a lot of the commits in the ZFS improvements. And this is his blog post that kind of explains how the virtual file system layer works and using ZFS as an example so that you can have real-world examples as you're walking through it. And since, more people know about how the basics of how ZFS works than understand the VFS layer, mm-hmm. and so it's a good example. I found it really interesting to read all this.
Cool.
And it's quite long. I've got a low screen resolution on the machine here, but you can see this also has very useful graphics kind of explaining how things are working with how, you know, a rename operation and, you know, changes the existing parent-to-child mm-hmm. relationships and so on.
Okay. So, of course, we did have a previous episode where we did an interview with Hybrid Cluster back on episode 24. So we'll have the link in the show notes. You can refer back to that and kind of hear about what Hybrid Cluster does. So that's...
Yes, and why they have a bunch of people working full-time on ZFS. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay. So next up, a little bit of PCBSD news. So first up, Preload has been ported over, which is a daemon that prefetches applications that you use a lot. So they tend to run faster. They're already in memory. Also, some big news this last week, PCBSD developing our own desktop environment, Lumina. So we posted a FAQ on the blog, so you can kind of see a little bit about what this is, what it's not, where it's planning on going in the future. It's still in very active development, but you can try it out by installing it from the PCBSD Edge package repo. So if you're running the desktop, you can switch to that out now. We'll be showing a live demo of it in a few weeks when the development settles down a bit. It's still in a very early stage, so we want to wait for it to mature a little bit. And I guess we had a video somebody had sent us about some kid in Australia who puts his mom on camera while she tries out PCBSD and gives her impressions of it. So that is interesting.
Yes, she was. They liked how in the kickoff menu you had, rather than Firefox or Conqueror, it just said mm-hmm. Internet Browser. So that, you know, with each, it's got the name underneath, but it's got what it does. And for someone that's coming from Windows or whatever and is used to clicking on that certain icon without even knowing what it means, just never really thought of it this way, but the fact that Internet Explorer shows up as Internet mm-hmm. and you click it, it kind of makes sense, right? And they had some good impressions and points about what it was, and they seem to kind of share the opinion that if you were coming from Linux, you would be kind of at home on here because it's
a lot of the same applications
that you're used to. Yeah, it's not really that different. You just get the mm-hmm. benefits like the ZFS and boot environments and the general stability mm-hmm. of BSD and all the cool stuff.
Well, that's awesome. So, that's the end of our weekly feedback and news. We'll have some more PCBSD news in the next upcoming weeks. We're doing, as a sneak peek, a lot of updates to how we do application management. So there will be some neat stuff happening in that arena that we'll announce. Okay, as usual, we'd like to mention that all our tutorials are going to be posted in their entirety at bsdnow.tv, including all the past ones. So if there's something you missed and want to go back and look at, please do so. If you would like to send your questions, comments, show ideas, topics, or stories that you found interesting, go ahead and send that over to feedback@bsdnow.tv. And we'll try and work that into a future episode. If you've got something cool you want to talk about, and maybe you want to come on for an interview, send an email as well so we know to schedule you.
Yes.
If you have any tutorial requests, something that you'd like to see done or you think other people would be interested in, again, send that in to feedback@bsdnow.tv, and we'll see if we can get that added in a future episode. And we want to mention it looks like that OpenBSD 5.5 CD sets are starting to show up in people's mailboxes. So we'll... Yeah.
Yep. So you can get
yours
ordered if you want.
Yeah, we'll have some full details on the release next week. And a reminder... If you're running FreeBSD, they just issued 3 security advisories yesterday that you need. They include another OpenSSL fix, a remote DDoS crash, and then jails being able to access the host system's raw devices. So important security fixes. PCBSD users will be pushing that patch out later tonight, so we're already in the process of building those. As usual, you can watch live Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time or 1800 UTC, and we would enjoy having you guys with us on the live show so we can interact with you maybe if you're in the chat room, which would be pretty slick. Mm-hmm. But anyway, thank you guys so much for being on the show with us this week, and glad you're out there, and hope to be back the same time next week.